Now, The Interpreter Show, with discussion, debate, and the latest information on all kinds of religious issues and topics.
All right, we are back. You are listening to Interpreter Foundation Radio, sponsored by LDSAgents.com. If you are looking to buy or sell a home, especially in this market, and heaven sakes, I wouldn't want to do that by myself at all. With the way things are today, please go to LDSAgents.com. They're a network of over 2,000 LDS agents, real estate agents. They will help you in selling or buying a new home. They'll help you find a new neighborhood, find a place where you feel comfortable, a place where you can, you know, if you need a specialty school for a child with special needs abilities, or, you know, any other need. If you need a certain ward you need to be near or at, they can certainly help you there. They have a wide array of agents and years of experience. So go to their useful website to get more information. It's LDSAgents.com. Once again, LDSAgents.com. So this is the Interpreter Radio Show on KTalk Radio, 1640 AM. My name is Mark Johnson. I'm your host tonight. I am very fortunate to be in the studio with Martin Tanner. He's over there. He's waving. And as well as BYU professor Matthew Bowen. Aloha, Matt.
Aloha.
Aloha. I am so glad to have you guys with us tonight. And we're going to be discussing in this second segment of the Interpreter Radio Show the upcoming Come Follow Me lesson, which will be covering sections of the Doctrine and Covenants 94 through 97. And we've asked Matt if he could give us an introduction to these sections and tell us what to expect as we read them.
Yeah. One of the things that we should bear in mind just from the outset is that Doctrine and Covenants 94... it was in every edition prior to the 2013 edition of the scriptures. It's been misdated. In fact, it should. Doctrine and Covenants section 94 was given on the same day as Doctrine and Covenants 97. And so, really, what we need to do in terms of discussing these sections right here is begin with Doctrine and Covenants section 95. And Doctrine and Covenants section 95 comes about 5 months or so after the revelation in Doctrine and Covenants 88, which pressed upon the Latter-day Saints in Kirtland the need to build a temple. And by this time, by June 1st, nothing really had happened on that. And so this is the revelation that's given from the Lord to the prophet Joseph Smith here really sort of tries to get that back center, front and center on their radar. Mm-hmm. The prophet, this is something that Steve Harper, if you go to Doctrine and Covenants Central, he has a lot of great introductions that he's written for this website and for for all of the sections. Mm-hmm. But one of the things that he noted was something that he noted that the prophet Joseph Smith seems to have been the only one member of the church really at this point who was really feeling the urgency of the need to build the temple. He'd written the Saints in Missouri about this, I think a letter to William W. Phelps, where he talked about the importance of building the temple. But the Latter-day Saints in Kirtland and in Missouri have been slow to do this. And so that's one of the things that's going to be the theme that's going to overarch all four of these sections that will be under discussion today is the importance of building the temple and matters pertaining thereto, like the law of consecration, mm-hmm. as being lived in Kirtland. But the issue of building the temple in Kirtland and when we get to Doctrine and Covenants 97, the Lord was even as the Saints are being driven out of Jackson County, he's still emphasizing the importance of building the temple.
Mm-hmm. Terrific. All right, so let's start then. Should we start with 95, as you mentioned?
Yeah, let's start with 95, and then we can cover 95, 96, and those sections that are really Kirtland-focused, and then go to 97, which is more Missouri-focused, and then finish with 94, which is also Kirtland-focused, even though it was given the same day as the as Section 97.
Yeah, I think that is something that is easy to overlook, too, is the fact that the geography of, you know, these sections and the priorities, you know, of you know, what they're dealing with, you know, will shift from state to state.
And it's hard to keep straight. And it's important to bear in mind as we look at these sections, you know, try to figure out which saint, you know, which body of saints sometimes is being addressed. Because that then you can dig more into the historical context, and that really helps flesh out some of these sections. If you're just reading this straight through with no historical context, a lot of what's said in these revelations will, not all of it will make sense. Some of it will, in fact, some things will seem kind of strange unless you're willing to look at the particular issue that's being dealt with.
Yeah, so it might appear that there's, you know, some flip-flopping. We've got, you know, a group that's doing really well and they're not doing well, but if we know that there are actually two different groups that the Lord is talking about, you know, then that could, you know, help us in our understanding and, you know, make it easier to have a correct understanding of these verses. So, section 95, I think in the first verse, it really is one of the most powerful verses in the Doctrine and Covenants. It talks about how, where the Lord mentions this, you know, almost doctrinal declaration that, you know, he says that those whom I love, you know, I will chasten. And for my chastisement, I will prepare a way for the deliverance in all things out of temptation. And then I think is the kicker where he said, you know, and I read it with a pause almost. And he says, and, you know, I have loved you. You know, we can therefore say, and therefore you're going to get chastised, which is exactly what happens.
And this is something the prophet himself knew something about and had experienced. You know, you watch the movie Witnesses, mm-hmm. and the way that it brings out that experience of the Lord chastening the prophet over the lost manuscript pages.
Mm-hmm. How he, you know, the plates are taken from him, and he lost the ability to translate.
So this is a pattern with which the prophet himself is familiar.
And I would imagine that'd be a pattern with all of us. Hopefully, the way the Lord deals with us. And I think that oftentimes it's easy to dwell on the idea that we're being chastened, and it's easy to overlook the idea that, you know, he loves us as well.
And apparently the sin here is not just some minor thing. It doesn't say it's a bad sin. It says it's a grievous sin. But it doesn't even just say it's a grievous sin. It says it's a very grievous sin. So this is a big deal to the Lord. This is a major, major kind of a thing. And what is it? Well, haven't been serious about building the house of the Lord. And that's shows the significance of that, and, well,
gives it a lot of weight.
Yeah, in fact, I'm really drawn to this language in verse 6. And he uses that word grievous again, where he says, they who are not chosen have sinned a very grievous sin, in that they are walking in darkness at noonday. And this idea that of walking in darkness comes up. It'll come up again in verse 12. Verse 11 and 12. In fact, this is sort of connected to what we were talking about with Dr. Halverson's article.
Oh, yes.
Verily I say unto you, it is my will that you should build a house. If you keep my commandments, you shall have power to build it. You almost hear echoes of the the Lehitic covenant.
Mm-hmm. You shall prosper in the land.
If you keep not my commandments, the love of the Father shall not continue with you. Therefore, you shall walk in darkness. That, to me, maybe describes what it means to be cut off from the presence of the Lord, as well as anything else in the scriptures that I'm aware of. This idea of walking in darkness because you don't have the temple and you don't have the blessings of the temple. And that's another thing that phrase, being cut off from the presence of the Lord, had reference to.
Mm.
Being cut off from the house of the Lord, the ritual presence of the Lord, and the place where the ordinances, those divine ordinances pertaining to the holy priesthood, are available.
Yeah, and just by way of contrast, skipping ahead just a little bit, going back to section 94. Let's see. He says, talking about the temple, he says, if there shall be any unclean thing, you know, coming into it, my glory shall not be there, and my presence shall not come into it. And these terminologies, they're using the, you know, glory and presence. These are not, you know, things that are thrown around lightly in the scriptures. They have, you know, very significant meanings, you know, glory and presence. You know, these are temple-related themes.
That word kavod in Hebrew, when you go back into the writings of the Old Testament, it's an extremely important temple-connected word, as is the word panim, as it pertains to the Lord's presence.
Mm-hmm. No, that's glory and face.
There's a Jewish scholar that suggests any time you see the phrase before the Lord in the Old Testament, lifnei Adonai, which means literally to the face of Yahweh or Jehovah, we're dealing with some kind of temple situation. And that phrase, by the way, turns up a lot in the Book of Mormon and elsewhere.
But, yeah, it does. And that's you know, I think the source of, you know, maybe the Lord's frustration with, you know, the saints not taking this command to build the temple, you know, them taking this, you know, command lightly, and, you know.
Yeah, in fact, that's when they come into condemnation often for treating lightly or not taking seriously enough what the Lord is trying to give them. Mm-hmm. So you definitely see it, sense the Lord who is patient, some of that patience wearing thin in these sections.
Mm. Yeah, and for, you know, us, you know, modern readers, you know, us, you know, who are going through our Come Follow Me sections, it really, you know, hammers home the idea of not taking the temple for granted, you know, and utilizing the blessings. My wife and I were able to go to the temple this past Wednesday, you know, after, you know, a very long, you know, hiatus, because of the shutdowns from COVID and everything. And it was just wonderful to be there again.
I've told my students that I will never, ever take for granted the opportunity to be in a person-to-person class, face-to-face class again, after we lost the opportunity to do that and had to do these online classes, which, frankly, for a teacher like me, they are not as enjoyable.
Mm-hmm.
So I vowed that I would never take that the opportunity to have those classes for granted again. And I hope, as Latter-day Saints, I think that I've kind of felt the same way about the temple, that one of the great deprivations over the past year and a half or so has been you know, the restriction from being able to attend the temple and be there in the house of the Lord. And I don't ever want to take that privilege or opportunity for granted ever again.
No, me neither. And, you know, I've had definite experiences during the pandemic when, you know, we were doing home church. And when I've just had, you know, opportunities to meditate upon the endowment and the covenants that I've made in the temple. And I've had, you know, many experiences where, you know, the Lord has nudged me one way or the other, saying, you know, the blessings are still valid, you know, because you can't go. You know, that's, I've got this. You know, it's taken care of. But now that, you know, the restrictions are coming off, you know, I do feel the need to, you know, step up and do my part again. And it's just such an enjoyable and beautiful experience going back into the temple and being before the face of God.
It's interesting that the discussion you've centered on talks about the difference between something that's distant and actually something that's close, that you can see, that's personal, and how it's not quite the same, even with students, of being close and distant, although I can think of some students in a few classes I've been in that we would have all wished were a little more distant, but that's, you know, another hopefully story. not the norm. And section 93 that was last week has this wonderful verse in it that talks about if you obey the commandments and if you don't sin, you can see my face. That's paraphrased, but mm-hmm. but the gist of it is that you can see my face and know that I am. That theme comes up many, many times, and it's important because seeing God is different from even having a revelation from God at a distance or in being inspired by Him. There's something that's much, much different than that. And in section 94 that we're talking about today, you have a similar statement in verse 8 that talks about coming in there and His glory being there and His presence being there. It doesn't quite say see my face, but it says everything but. Mm-hmm. And then you go on, and it has this, and I'm skipping around a little bit here, but section 95 in verse 8 has one of these Doctrine and Covenants references to endowed with power from on high, which is sort of the earliest way that the endowment was referenced. Now everybody just calls it the endowment. Mm-hmm. And I often think that if we use the full phrase that we'd get a little more of the import. And I often believe that it's no coincidence that all these verses come at about the same time, and that part of the endowment of power from on high is said very close in proximity to the time of being able to see God and being able to learn so much by this endowment, which, you know, if you know the truth and the truth will make you free, and if you learn things, then you have the power to know what's right and what isn't right, and you have the power to do things. And I believe that the endowment of power from on high involves learning, and specifically temple learning. That's mm-hmm. that's the logical conclusion here. So,
in fact, the repetition or reiteration of that expression, endowed with power from on high, you know, brings it back to this is language that the Lord has used previously, and it goes all the way back to the New Testament in terms of the power that was promised to the Christ's disciples. Mm-hmm. When you read in Luke 24, and it's really interesting to me that we, from the beginning, it's been the Lord's desire to endow those sent out on missions with power from on high. That's a big part of what the Lord wanted to do with the Kirtland Temple, and making it a place where, you know, that there it would be a house of learning. Mm-hmm. And preparation, learning those, you know, sacred temple truths. And today, anytime we send a missionary out on a full-time mission, one of the prerequisites, one of the things that has to happen before, almost in most cases, and I think today overwhelmingly so, sister or elder has to have received their endowment in the temple. Why? Because they need to be endowed with power from on high in order to carry out the mission of testifying of Christ inviting people to repent and live the doctrine of Christ.
Exactly, and I believe that that's, you know, you're exactly right. That's why, well, one of the reasons why, you know, the prophet was so eager to, you know, get the temple built was to reinforce, you know, the missionaries that were going out. There's a marvelous book by, his name is Carl Ricks Anderson. He's the brother of Richard Lloyd Anderson, who's, you know, one of the specialists, you know, late Richard Lloyd Anderson, specialist on the witnesses.
Yeah, the one to whom the film is dedicated. Mm-hmm. He's the witness to the witnesses.
He is, yeah. His brother is, you know, no slouch of a scholar himself. He has one of his books is called The Savior in Kirtland, and it's personal accounts of divine manifestations in Kirtland. It's a marvelous book, and I don't get any royalties, but, you know, go out and buy it. It's awesome. One of his chapters talks about how, you know, Christ will protect his people and his missionaries, and it gives, you know, examples, Matt, of these exact things you were talking about, you know, different encounters that, you know, the early saints and the early missionaries like Zebedee Coltrane and, you know, Sidney Rigdon and others have had, in their preparation to go out and preach the gospel as they've left and as, you know, they've recently get their endowments and just you know, all during this time, how the adversary has stepped up his attacks on them. And the prophet Joseph Smith, you know, upon hearing of these attacks, was pleased because he knows that, you know, God is watching out for them, and he says these attacks confirm the reality of, you know, your divinely appointed mission.
Yeah, one of the things that strikes me too in these revelations, you know, the Lord makes these promises about Zion, you know, becoming fruitful and flourishing,
mm-hmm.
but the Latter-day Saints then and now, we need to realize that Zion doesn't just flourish as on its own. It's not just something that the Lord promises and then we just sit back and wait for it to happen.
Mm-hmm.
I think the saints needed to understand that they're building the temple and they're doing it the Lord's way and receiving the blessings that he wanted to pour out on them his way was crucial for them then to be able to help the church get to where it needed to go. And, you know, we're still learning this. All of us, you know, we were talking about human frailty earlier. All mm-hmm. of us have it. All of us are subject to it. We are. But the sooner we realize the importance of keeping the immediate commandments that the Lord's giving us, and the more we get the temple into our lives, the less we're going to walk in darkness, and the more Zion in our homes and then abroad is going to flourish.
Yeah, I agree, and you know, that's one of the things that I really picked up again from, you know, my last temple visit. Was just the importance of having, you know, good feelings between, you know, everyone there, everyone who was participating, you know, that there were no unkind thoughts or unkind feelings between, you know, anyone there, you know, so we weren't distracted, you know, and so the spirit could be with us and not, you know, leave us alone in darkness. So, you know, these sections and these verses really provide a good template and a good model for, you know, our own worship in our temples.
I just wanted to, before we leave section 95, I mm-hmm. wanted to just point out there's an interesting title given for the Lord in verse 7. He says, "And for this cause I gave unto you a commandment that you should call your solemn assembly, that your fastings and your mournings might come up into the ears of the Lord of Sabaoth, which is by interpretation the creator of the first day, the beginning and the end." Years ago, I wrote a really long paper on just this verse and this title because it's caused so much confusion.
Mm-hmm.
I've heard people when they read this verse, they'll say the Lord of Sabbath. That is not the word Sabbath.
No.
That's a Hebrew word, Sabaoth, mm-hmm. which means hosts. This is a Anglicization of the Hebrew word Sabaoth, and it's
kind of, like Yahweh would be.
Yeah, it's
original or an original older version of Jehovah, as we would.
Yeah, and
say.
A lot of scholars think that this is that Yahweh Sabaoth is the original longer form of a name. Frank Moore Cross, for example, mm-hmm. has written on this. What's interesting is if that's correct, the name Yahweh or Jehovah would mean something like he creates or he brings to pass.
Mm-hmm.
He makes happen. And that connects the name Yahweh with the Hebrew verb Hayah, which means to be or to become.
Mm-hmm.
But what's interesting about it to me is that this title, the Lord of Sabaoth or Yahweh Sabaoth, which is by interpretation the creator of the first day,
mm-hmm.
the name Jehovah, what the scholars think about the origin and meaning of that name are correct, then the name is connected with he creates or he makes happen or he brings to pass. It's actually, when we see that phrase come up again and again in the Book of Mormon,
mm-hmm.
And it came to pass. There, the Hebrew term vayihi, and it came to pass,
mm-hmm.
Or vahaya, and it shall come to pass. Some scholars think that the when the Lord says in the scriptures, "I am the Lord," he's saying in effect, "I am the one who makes it happen." And this often that phrase comes after a threat or a promise of judgment. I'm going to make it. I am the Lord. I'm going to make it happen. So it's interesting that scholars like Margaret Barker have connected the hosts Sabaoth with the first day actually of creation, the very beginning of creation. And then the phrase on the end of that, the beginning and the end. So there's a lot there, and critics of the church and critics of the prophet Joseph Smith, who said that he just mistook this for
Sabbath.
Lord of Sabbath, and he was talking about Sunday.
Mm-hmm.
That is completely off the mark in terms of what this verse is talking about. So I think it's really interesting that the Lord gives this title and talks about himself as the creator of the first day, connecting that name with Yahweh or Jehovah,
mm-hmm.
In the context of him reiterating the importance of building the temple and that there are good things that are going to be coming
mm-hmm.
if they do it, and there are going to be problems if they don't follow through.
Yeah. Yeah, and the temple is certainly a place where we learn about, the first day.
A few verses earlier in verse 4, we have this reference that I briefly mentioned earlier, this strange act. Well, what's the strange act that's talked about in Isaiah? It's God's fighting against his own people. That's a little bit like that. In a minor form, all those reminiscences that you wish you could forget of when you had a fight with your dad when you were a kid, doesn't come out so well. He still loves you, but he's fighting with you if you're doing something wrong,
mm-hmm.
in effect. And that's the one of the references here. And, Matt, that's an action, a severe action that is being discussed here right before the verse that you're talking about. And so the inference to that, putting together what you said with what's been mentioned before, is, you're messing up pretty bad. You're not doing what you're supposed to. You forgot what I commanded you. You haven't built my house yet. And as a result, I'm going to fight against you. And a few verses down in verse 7, like you're saying, and that doesn't mean metaphorically necessarily this is a real deal, because I have the power to create, and that's a real thing. That's not just some vague inference or something. So take this very, very seriously. That's sort of the implication of all of this in you know, modern vernacular.
Yeah, oh, I like that. And that's one of the things I'm trying to teach my kids as well, is just, you know, how to appreciate the power of prayer, you know, and because they're going to be talking to, you know, the one who created everything.
Yeah. In fact, what sometimes we wonder, well, why are the creation accounts so important? We've got four of them, three of them in our canonized scriptures, mm-hmm. one in the creation account in the temple.
Mm-hmm.
One of the things that has occurred to me for a long time is, you know, after that in Genesis, you get the account of Abraham and the Abrahamic covenant and the promises made to Abraham. And then we see the Lord's ability to make them happen,
mm-hmm.
to make happen what he's promised. And I think that's what Martin's talking about here. This isn't just a rhetorical flourish in the revelation. This is a reminder of who the saints are dealing with here, who their God is.
Mm-hmm.
He's the one that's created it. He makes it happen. And it is a matter of spiritual life or death to either do and give heed to the commandments that he's given them, or they're going to, the love of the Father isn't going to continue with them, and they're going to continue to walk in darkness.
Yeah. One wonderful point. I've had discussions many times over the years with critics or even some members of the church looking at Genesis, for example, and saying, God, you know, I have a really hard time with this, because how do we get the earth created and, you know, the sun, and after that you get the stars, and, you know, how does all the order out of place here, you know, really work? And I think, you've just missed the point. You've totally missed the point.
Mm-hmm.
The Jews who wrote this, and I'm not going to get into a discussion of where Genesis came from, because that would be a topic for a different day and would take a long, long time. But the point is that those who created Genesis as we have it today had a different model than we have. There's no question. Their working model for the universe was different than ours, and it doesn't work the same way scientifically that ours does. The same way that Newtonian physics doesn't really work very well with particle physics, but it still served everyone just fine. It still does, mm-hmm. still does today. The point of Genesis isn't the order of things or what got created and what didn't and what later got, you know, destroyed in a flood. The point is, I'm who created everything, not just some stuff, not mm-hmm. just a little bit. I organized everything out of what's there. It's not a minor thing when you're talking to people who can hardly deal with some of the minor things in life in some little pinprick of time
mm-hmm.
in a small little location on Earth. This is the power beyond all kings, power beyond all governments, power beyond everything, and it's difficult for people to grasp the significance of that, and yet that's who we're dealing with, and that's the point of this verse, I think, at least in a polite nudge, is
mm-hmm.
I'm really important, don't forget it, and build the house that I asked you to. This is one of the most important things you could do. Don't overlook it, or you'll be sorry.
Yeah. You'll be walking in darkness as if it, you know, noonday. And I don't want that. I like the light. I like being, you know, at least thinking that the Lord is mindful of me. You know, it helps me navigate being in the light, and helps me share that with my kids and my family and everyone else. So yeah, it's a big deal. You know, we need to take these verses and everything, you know, quite seriously.
As we move on to Doctrine and Covenants section 96, it's interesting. Stephen Harper made another great comment on this. He said,
he's good, isn't he?
He is very good. He mentioned that this section, it's sort of like coming in on the middle of a really interesting conversation, but you haven't been there for mm-hmm. the first part of it.
Mm-hmm.
But in order to, he recommends that as background for Section 96, Doctrine and Covenants 42, 72, 78, and 82, which talk about the law of consecration.
Mm-hmm.
And so a lot of what is this revelation has in view is the issue of land,
mm-hmm.
in particular what was known among the saints then as the French Farm. Peter French was an early settler in the Kirtland area.
Mm-hmm.
And this land was where they intended to build the temple. I think in the manual, the church manual for Come Follow Me for sections 94 through 97, one of the things they mention is Numbers chapter 2, verses 1 and 2 in the Old Testament, where Israel was to be oriented around the
mm-hmm.
temple,
mm-hmm.
and in the communities, the pioneer communities out here in Utah, you can see some of this notion carry over, that the temple sort of would be the, and Hugh Nibley talked a lot about this as well, where the temple could and should be sort of at the center of the community. Where I live and teach out in Laie, Hawaii, it's interesting because the temple was really the, I wouldn't say it's the first thing there,
mm-hmm.
but really it's at the center of everything that's now there in the community in terms of, you don't have the temple there because the university's there or because the PCC is there.
Oh, okay.
You have the university there and the PCC there because the temple is there. And then it's that kind of community of saints because the temple is there.
Mm-hmm.
So the idea that we sort of, if not literally, orient ourselves to the temple and that we're a temple-centric people that way, the idea is that we orient our lives toward it. And that's sort of a part of what's going on here in Section 96.
So just it gives us the Lord's, or he's giving us, you know, his importance of the temple by making it the center, you know, kind of the center point on which we can all build around, and, you know, have everything be, you know, maybe even peripheral to that, you know, our farms and our jobs. But at the center of it all, you know, needs to be the temple.
That's a common theme that the church and its members have forever after until now. When they got to Missouri, we still have the city map and the plot, and the center place is the temple, and the rest of it sort of goes out from that center spot. And, of course, the temple in Missouri isn't an ordinary temple. It's more like a temple complex with
mm-hmm.
different features than a temple today. But the temple in Nauvoo sits in a very prominent place. You may not call it the actual center of town, but it's in a very prominent place.
Mm-hmm.
And similarly in Salt Lake, of course, it was close to the center of the way Salt Lake City was laid out. It
mm-hmm.
certainly isn't the center now. It even wasn't then, but it was in a very, very prominent location. And all of the locations for temples seem to be that way. The temple in Hawaii is like that, very prominent place
mm-hmm.
where you aren't going to miss it for miles in the Salt Lake Valley, the Jordan River Temple, the Draper Temple,
Oker Mountain
is
sure.
Just way up there on the hill. They're in prominent places where they're not going to be forgotten, where life and other things can revolve around them. So one never forgets the purpose of the temple because it's not hidden.
No, exactly. And I think if, you know, maybe a critic might say, oh, they're just, you know, getting nice views and nice landscapes, but you know, there's a purpose to that. We want our temples to be seen. You know, we want them to be, you know, lights unto the world. You know, we don't want them hidden in some canyon somewhere where you just can't get to it or can't see it. You know, we believe that these are the house of the Lord, and you know, we're gonna show them off. We build them with the finest materials, and by golly, we're gonna make sure everyone sees them. And I appreciate that as a member who goes there.
Absolutely. The attitude towards the temple is such that we never will there be a time when somebody will go to the First Presidency and say, "Yep, we got this really good budget deal on used material for."
Mm-hmm.
It's not going to happen. It will never happen. It's always the best of the best of the best, so that reverence to God is not forgotten.
No, and it does really show a dedication and the seriousness that, you know, the brethren and the church leaders have, you know, now. I certainly don't see us receiving the same kind of condemnation that, you know, was shown in early, you know, section of 95, or at least not on the subject of temples, at least. I'm sure that the Lord has plenty of other warnings and other things for us to be chastised with.
Yeah. And this is not some new odd way to build a temple that was devised by Joseph Smith and the Latter-day Saints. The early descriptions of the temple in Jerusalem were spectacular. This was one of the marvels of the ancient world. People described the glistening of the sun off from the walls of the temple as being blinding at times, and it was a spectacular structure that would definitely give someone pause and would make someone in the ancient world who maybe thought of other deity or didn't know much about the Jewish concept of God, they would say, wow, they take their God very seriously, and he is powerful.
And you want to talk about temples being built in a prominent place. The temple in Jerusalem was built on, you know, the rock where they believed that Abraham sacrificed Isaac. This was, you know, a very, very important and very historic site for them.
Yeah, nearer to us in our times, you have. I lived when I was doing my graduate work out in Washington, D.C., near the Washington, D.C. Temple, which I think will be open again this coming year. But they had it's in a very prominent spot as well if you drive around the Beltway in D.C. And in fact, you're coming towards Virginia from the Maryland side, and it just jumps right out at you. I think they actually had to turn down the lights on that.
I've heard that.
Years ago, because it really jumps out at you, and that's not always the desired phenomenon with people speeding out on a an interstate. But I think this brings up an interesting word that comes up. We see it in Doctrine and Covenants 97:10, and then again in 94. You know, again, these revelations were received on the same day, on August 2nd, 1833. Mm-hmm. The Lord keeps referring to the pattern. Doctrine and Covenants 97:10, and I see it again in Doctrine and Covenants 94:2. And 94:12, the temple, and actually these other buildings that the Lord commands to be built for the work of the First Presidency and the work of the printing, that they were to be done according to a divine pattern.
Mm-hmm.
The word in Exodus chapter 25, verses 8 and 9, and I think in the last verse, I want to say that's verse 40 of chapter 25, there's this word, Hebrew word, tabnit, which comes from the root, from the same root that the ancient Israelites used to describe building.
Mm-hmm.
But they're talking about a divine design, that this had to be done the Lord's way. The tabernacle was built that way in Moses' time, that there was a divine logic to it, a divine pattern in mind. Mm-hmm. Solomon does the same thing later on. And I think Nephi had reference to this in 1 Nephi 18 when he talks about building the ship that the Lord commanded him to build.
Mm-hmm.
That was after the manner which the Lord showed to him, and not after the manner of men, which makes sense when you consider what the function of the boat was. That, you know, most seagoing vessels at the beginning of the 6th century BC could not have transported Lehi and that whole clan across oceans to get them to the New World. And so, again, that's another lesson here, that the Lord wanted it done in order for the blessings to be what they needed to be for the saints. He had a pattern in mind, and he wanted the temple and the related buildings built in his way.
Yeah.
The Greek word is interesting, is typos, or type. It's where we get the word type. And that invites then, when you get into Hebrews 8:5, and the idea of the temple, it's not just a divine pattern in terms of architecture, but there are Christological types that point us to Jesus Christ.
Hmm.
When we start to break down the design of the temple, the ordinances of the temple, and we look at what they mean, it's all pointing us to Jesus Christ. It's everything typifies him when we view it the right way.
So even the layout and the architecture,
all of that is pointing us to him as Lord and Creator. And
I'll testify back. One eternal round, it all comes
exactly.
All comes back around. There is a account that Frederick D. Williams gave when the pattern of the temple was shown. This was recorded by Truman O. Angel, who helped design or diagram and plot the temple there at Kirtland, as well as design the Salt Lake Temple. So Truman O. Angel recorded this account based on Frederick Williams's narrative, and Frederick G. Williams was in the first presidency with Joseph Smith and Sidney Rigdon at the time. So these are Frederick G. Williams' words. He says, "Joseph received the word of the Lord for him to take his two counselors, Williams and Rigdon, and to come before the Lord, and he would show them the plan or model of the house of the Lord to be built. We went upon our knees and called upon the Lord, and the building appeared within viewing distance. I being the first to discover it, then all of us viewed it together. After we had taken a good look of the exterior, the building seemed to come right over us, and the makeup of this hall seemed to coincide with what I saw there to the minutia." So they saw in vision how the temple needed to look. At first they saw it from a distance, they saw the exterior, and then they found themselves inside the temple. And then he mentions that, you know, being in the hall there at the time, or in the temple, you know, it matches the things they saw to the minutia.
I think when in the Old Testament, when they use the word tabnit, I think that's the kind of experience that the text wants us to understand that Moses has, that Solomon has, and so forth.
With other structures like Nephi, you know, building the boat, and, you know, perhaps Noah, according to, you know, some sources and legends, building the ark the same way, according to the same pattern.
And it's there in 1 Nephi 18 where Nephi says, I went into the mount oft and prayed unto the Lord oft, wherefore the Lord showed unto me great things. So that implies a vision that he's helping, he's showing Nephi what it is visually
that he needs to build, and what it needs to look like. And here we find, and Joseph Smith and Sidney Rigdon and Frederick G. Williams, you know, have the same experience. The Lord works the same way for them by showing them the you know, even the finest details of what the temple needs to look like. And it was up to them to make sure it happened.
In our closing minutes here, I wanted to mention just a couple of things about section 97. One is that it, I've often thought, is very much like the idea that reprove betimes with sharpness, and then afterwards show an excess of love, lest thee be esteemed to be an enemy. God does this here. The Lord does this here. He chastises the saints for not building his house, and then he even goes further, and in verse 6 gives us this very graphic metaphor where he says, you know, the axe is laid at the root of the tree. He says, I'm ready to chop here. All I got to do is, you know, back and down, and mm-hmm. that's it. You know, this is the 11th hour. You're right at the end. And he tells them that they haven't done all the things that he's wanted them to do. And this is about as harsh as it gets. This is pretty harsh language from God chastising them. But then, after he says all that, you go on to verse 15 and 16 and 17, and he tells them about how wonderful it will be if they actually listen and do this, and that they will be able to see him. And this to me is just a beautiful way of using both a stick and a carrot in conjunction mm-hmm. in the sticks first and then the carrots after with great love attached to it. And I thought, you know, that is the most brilliant way to motivate somebody. You give them a little to worry about, and mm-hmm. then you give them a lot to anticipate, and then you tell them how much you love them. I mean, how much better could the blueprint for that be? I've just always loved this little section, even though it starts out sounding quite harsh.
Mm-hmm. And it's interesting that this comes on August 2nd, 1833, and just days previous to this, the saints in Jackson County, to whom this is directed, had mm-hmm. been forced to sign an agreement to leave Jackson County. And you know, distances being what they were back then, the scholars have wondered, well, could the prophet of Joseph Smith have even known about this?
Yeah.
I think a lot would suggest to you that he himself probably didn't know exactly what the plight of the saints was.
Yeah, I'm sure their cell phones were really primitive at the time. They probably couldn't text or anything like that. So,
but it's interesting because I think the Lord did have a sense of what their plight was. Mm-hmm. And, in fact, I think it's reflected in verse 21 when he expands the definition of Zion. The Lord understands that, you know, the saints at this time referred to Zion, they were thinking very geographically in terms of Jackson County and mm-hmm. Missouri. But it's sort of here that you get in these sections, it really starts to widen, the definition of Zion really starts to widen out. The Lord says, verily, verse 21, therefore, thus saith the Lord, let Zion rejoice, for this is Zion, the pure in heart. Therefore, let Zion rejoice while all the wicked shall mourn. I think that would have been a real message of comfort to the saints who, you know, are being moved off their land mm-hmm. in Jackson County at the time. I know we're short on time. I did want to make sure we had some technical difficulties at the beginning of the show, but Steve Densley could not be with us tonight because of the passing of his father. Mm-hmm. We just wanted to let Steve know, if he's listening out there, that we love him and that our thoughts are with him and his family.
And our prayers as well.
And prayers as well. And they've been, you talk about Zion and families who have contributed to the building up of the kingdom of God and the establishment of Zion, and the Densley family, they're, you know, among the greats in that. So just wanted to say, make sure that Steve knew our thoughts and prayers
had our love. And then I'd like to invite any listeners who'd like to join in praying for the family to, you know, certainly join us as well. So it's been a pleasure. Brother and Matt and Martin, it's a real treat to be on the radio with you guys, and you know, let's do this again soon. Hopefully, we can get Steve with us. And Martin, it's always fun to, you know, be with you and, you know, see how you're doing and pick your brain on things.
Absolutely.
And it's Matt, it's always good to get your Hebrew insights and your keen eyes for, you know, these observations of these kind of, you know, linguistic things and other little delicious minutiae.
Thank you, Mark. Thank you, Martin.
You're now a seasoned expert on the board, and we'd like to thank LDSAgents.com for sponsoring tonight and the Interpreter Foundation for this show. And go sign up for FAIR. Go sign up for FAIR.
Go sign up. Go watch Witnesses.
Yeah, if you haven't seen Witnesses, make sure that you get a chance to get the theatrical experience with that. It's not to be missed.
Yeah, you won't regret it. Have a good night and a good week, everyone. We'll see you back next week for more Interpreter Radio.